Was University Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. Death toll from the massive truck bombing in the Somali capital Mogadishu over the weekend has topped 270. Angry protesters took to the streets condemning Al-Shabaab, militant group which often claims attacks in Mogadishu has so far stayed silent. Deakin University's Greg Barton says the magnitude of the attack is a surprise, but not the attack itself.
The scale of this attack and the brutality captures our imagination, and the international community once again pays attention to Shabaab. It wouldn't come as news to anyone living in Somalia or Kenya.
Hundreds were wounded in the attack in Mogadishu, and the Somali government has called for 3 days of national mourning. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson told CNN Iran is in technical compliance with the international agreement to curb its nuclear weapons development, but said President Trump wants Congress to adapt a more complete strategy to fix what the U.S. leader sees as flaws in the pact. On NBC's Meet the Press, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley.
The goal at the end of the day is to hold Iran accountable, is to get them to be good community leaders, is to get them to stop all of these violations that they're doing. What we're trying to say is, look, the agreement was an incentive. The agreement was for you to stop doing certain things. You haven't stopped doing certain things. So what do we do to make Iran more accountable so that they do?
The Iran nuclear agreement was signed in 2015 between Tehran, the U.S., European Union, France, Britain, Germany, Russia, and China. And U.S.-backed Syrian militias say they have launched their final assault on Raqqa, the city in the Islamic State it claims as its capital. This is VOA News. People in the disputed northern Iraqi city of Kirkuk reported hearing shelling and gunfire early today, while militia and Kurdish forces exchanged artillery fire. Clashes came as Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi ordered Iraqi security forces to impose security in the city in cooperation with the inhabitants and the Kurdish Peshmerga. Sebastian Kurz, the 31-year-old charismatic Conservative Party leader, has declared victory in Austria's general election, putting him on track to be Europe's youngest leader. Observers say Kurz has succeeded in reinventing the Conservative Party and galvanizing the Austrian right, including the far right, following the breakdown of a coalition between conservatives and socialists. Natalie Doyle is a Europe scholar at Monash University.
I think this election in fact confirms a trend that that's been evident in Europe for a while, which means that the left is really on the back foot. It started in the Netherlands. It also became very obvious in the French elections, and the Austrian election confirms that the Austrian Socialist Party is in trouble. It was also apparent, I may add, in Germany. The only exception to that is the United Kingdom, where the Labour Party seems to have gained new life.
Campaign in Austria was dominated by the issue of immigration. Austria, with a population just under 9 million, accepted 90,000 asylum seekers, most of them Muslim, during the 2015 migrant crisis. Venezuela's opposition is hoping Sunday's regional elections will take a majority of state governorships from President Nicolas Maduro's ruling Socialist Party and give the opposition some momentum ahead of next year's presidential election. Protests this year against the Maduro government resulted in more than 120 deaths during clashes between government police and demonstrators. Wildfires in the U.S. state of California are spreading, with at least 40 killed so far. Jimmy Bernal is the fire captain in the historic town of Sonoma.
The biggest thing is we have lost way too many people on this fire. The intensity of the fire was incredible, so they're lost. And there's some multiple uncounted for, so the potential of more fatalities is huge, which is very, very sad.
One side of the fire zone stretched for 160 square kilometers, destroying some 5,700 homes and businesses. Another 100,000 people have evacuated their homes because of the fires that began 8 days ago and have been fueled by high winds and dry conditions. Get more at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Monday, October 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The death toll from Saturday's bomb blast in Somalia's capital has risen to 276.
I am sure the numbers will increase because, you know, there are a number of people who are missing. So this was just a horrific scene. Sometimes it's very even difficult to ascertain, you know, pieces and bits of human flesh.
Abdi Rashi Hashi is the director of the Heritage Institute for Policy Study, a Somalia-based think tank. Sierra Leone's ruling All People's Congress Party has chosen its candidate for the 2018 presidential election. And in Liberia, it's almost but certain that Senator George Weah will meet Vice President Joseph Boakai in a runoff election next month.
We would have loved to have won outrightly as we had anticipated. Notwithstanding, we also knew that as part of our calculus, we did know that a runoff was a possibility.
Wilma Pace, the national chair of Liberia's ruling Unity Party and a leading member of parliament in the Gambia, says President Adama Barrow needs to do more to bring about desired institutional changes in the country. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The death toll from Saturday's massive truck bombing in the Somali capital Mogadishu has risen to 276, according to the country's information minister, Abdirahman Osman. He also said in a tweet that about 300 people were wounded. The Somali government has described the bombing as the deadliest terror attack in the country's history. Meanwhile, angry protesters took to the streets condemning Al-Shabaab. The militant group, which often claims attacks in Mogadishu, has so far stayed silent. Abdi Rashi Hashi is the director of the Heritage Institute for Policy Study, a Somalia-based think tank. He said he believes the death toll is likely to rise because of the number of missing people. He also hoped the attack would get the Somali government to do away with political bickering and focus more on uniting the country to face the threat posed by Al-Shabaab.
I am sure the numbers will increase because, you know, there are a number of people who are missing. So this was just a horrific scene. Sometimes it's very even difficult to ascertain, you know, bits and bits of human flesh, you know, have been collected, and over 100 plus other deceased individuals cannot be identified because they were burned.
What does this say about Al-Shabaab's ability to carry out more deadly attacks?
You know, Al-Shabaab had the habit of conducting one of those complex raids or, you know, suicide bombing or track bombings like this. But this was much deadlier than before. And today, even it was just in the middle of a busy, it was like, you know, Times Square, you can describe in New York. It was just like, you know, somebody detonating major terror attack in the middle of town. So it was just like, you know, heavy, you know, very heavy traffic, people working on the street selling stuff, hotels, offices, shops. So it was the worst place this car bomb can go off. There has been definitely security lapses because they have to go through a number of checkpoints throughout the city to get where they were in the middle of town. And the result was just like death and destruction that Mogadishu has never seen. And Mogadishu has its share of terror in the past 20 plus years. When you look at the picture, it just resembles, you know, how Hiroshima or Nagasaki were in the Second World War. A lot of lives were cut short.
How do you think the Somali government can or should respond?
The government really needs to look itself in the mirror and realize Somalis are just facing very, very, very difficult enemy. They need to use this anger the Somali people have to mobilize the people so they can actually live their lives. And they also need to do away with all the political bickering and squabbling between the federal government and the regional government and other MPs and other politicians. We need the Somalis, especially the government, to lead and not to preside over a dysfunctional system. So they can use this opportunity to galvanize Somalis to have a common agenda, which is unity, and also to just, like, you know, face Al-Shabaab and also to just create internal stability. But now there are so many different unnecessary political problems that's actually making them distracted from the real action, which is to provide security for the citizens and also to provide services to the citizens who are also suffering in so many different ways.
So if that is the case, I mean, how do you respond to someone who is willing to die or to kill himself or herself and other people? Is there any better way for Somalia to respond?
Yes, you need to, you know, have an effective security apparatus, you know, that can actually, you know, prevent, that can secure the people, that can harness the information from the citizens, that can stop, you know, politicians fighting unnecessary political wars and being engaged in peace with side stories. They need to focus on mobilizing and making use of the citizens to find, you know, who is behind this. You know, Al-Shabaab, you know, are not just, you know, invisible force. Somebody knows what they are doing. A number of people knows what they are doing. So the government needs to reach out to the citizens, convince them to cooperate with them and help them with information. It also needs to focus on the tasks that it has been, you know, tasked to do, which is to serve the people. So I think the government can do better. And I think, you know, unfortunately, you know, the killing and the maiming of over 500 people should help them to refocus, because now they are not focusing on what they should have been working on.
Abdi Rashid Hashi is the director of the Heritage Institute for Policy Study, a Somalia-based think tank. He was speaking with me from the capital, Mogadishu. In Liberia, it's almost but certain that Senator George Weah of the Coalition for Democratic Change and Vice President Joseph Boakai of the ruling Unity Party will face each other in a runoff election next month. With 95.6% of all polling places covered, Election Commission Chair Jerome Kokoya announced Sunday that Senator Weah was leading with 39.5%, followed by Vice President Boakai with 29% of the vote.
Today we'll be reporting on 95.6% of polling places covered, 1,550,923 people turn off, representing 74.52%. Mr. George Weah of the CDC has acquired 572,453 votes, and that represents 39.0%. Mr. Joseph Newman Walker of the Unity Party got 427,550 votes, and that would be 29.1%. Mr. Charles Walker Bromskin of the Liberty Party, 144,359 votes. That would be 9.8%. Mr. Alexander B. Cummings of the ANC, 104,127 votes. That is 7.1%. Mr. Prince Y. Johnson of the Movement for Democracy and Reconstruction, MDR, 102,564 votes, and that represents 7.0%. Mr. Benanar Wilfred Ure of the ALP, 22,823 votes, and that represents 1.6%.
Jerome Kokoya is chair of the Elections Commission of Liberia. He spoke Sunday in the capital, Monrovia. The national chair of the ruling Unity Party of Liberia says the party is not considering changing staff for Vice President Joseph Boakai's election runoff campaign, but Wilmot Pei says there will be some modification, including addition of new people and redeploying of resources appropriately. He denied the alleged feud between the vice president's campaign and President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was responsible for the vice president not being able to win or overtake Weah's lead. Pei says if Vice President Boakai is to win the presidential runoff election, he must win on his own track record.
Our initial reaction is that we would have loved to have won outrightly as we had anticipated. Notwithstanding, we also knew that as part of our calculus, we did know that a runoff was a possibility. So we are not entirely surprised by that. But what is important is that voters now we have two clear options to choose from. And Liberians will now be in a position to see which of those options offers the best solutions, at least in the foreseeable future, to their country's many challenges.
Mr. Pei, as you know, you are the ruling party and the vice president has been vice president for 12 years. One would have thought that your party would be in the lead.
As I said earlier, we are not disappointed. The vice president is very upbeat. In fact, we have just been holding consultations with many of our team members to begin to recalibrate and gear up for a runoff that has now become an inevitability. In fact, we are receiving overtures from other actors, and the opportunity now has become more broadened. I can tell you that from all indications, eventually the runoff is something that will work to our full advantage.
The recalibration you talk about, would that include a shake-up of the vice president's campaign team, meaning having new people lead the campaign for the runoff election?
What's happening is that a runoff election for the campaigning period is usually limited to 2 weeks. So obviously, you have to make some adjustments, not necessarily by replacing your team with new people and all of that. We are not talking about changing the guard. It's about modifying, adding new people, redeploying our resources appropriately and within the limited time space that we have. I think that is more important.
Mr. Pei, coming into the general election, there was what some people would refer to as a feud between the vice president and President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. Do you think that feud might have hurt the vice president winning on the first ballot?
There is no feud between the two, as I know, as national chairman of the party. What has happened over the years, which will continue to happen, of course, is being the diverse political party that we are, there will continue to be disagreement. So what is also important, which people need to understand, is that if the vice president must be elected as president of this country, he must be elected on his track record. On the 40 years that he has served this country very, very diligently without any bad record, his integrity that has no comparison among even the most recent contenders, the 20 or the 19 order. So what is fundamental to us is the asset that he brings, the kind of leadership, the kind of quality leadership that he brings.
Are there plans for the vice president's campaign to reach out to President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and ask her for a more visible role in the runoff?
As I said earlier, there's no feud. They always meet. In fact, just last week they met, and I don't know what all the discourse they meet. Don't forget that she is the president of the republic and he is the vice president of the republic. They are working together. But what is important is that if the vice president must win the presidential runoff election to go on to eventually become the president of this country, he must win on his track record. It is not so much about having or not having a visible role for the president. What is important is that the vice president must take his case to the Liberian voter.
Mr. Pei, thank you very much for speaking with us on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you, Mr. Bodwin.
Wilma Pei is national chair of Liberia's ruling Unity Party, who is speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, October 16th, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 18 and a half minutes past the hour. Sierra Leone's ruling All People's Congress Party has chosen Dr. Samora Camara, the country's current foreign minister, as its candidate for the 2018 presidential election. His running mate will be Mohamed Cherno Maju Ba, the current deputy speaker of the House of Representatives. But some delegates at the party's convention complained that the candidates were preordained. Abdoulaye Birete, spokesman for Sierra Leone President Ernest Bai Koroma.
There was a unanimous endorsement after the National Advisory Committee, which is the highest decision-making body, met with all the stakeholders that emerged, including 28 flag bearer aspirants for the presidential nomination. After they've consulted with them, then His Excellency the President, Dr. Ernest Bai Koroma, in his capacity as chairman and leader of the party, was given the mandate to name the flag bearer for the party in a jam-packed hall in Makeni. And it was greeted with a very, very rapturous welcome.
Mr. Bereti, Mr. Kamara is the current foreign affairs minister, and his deputy now going into the election is going to be the current deputy speaker of the House of Representatives. How do you answer to this? Is business as usual, the status quo that President Koroma has had a hand to pick in these two individuals?
Well, as I mentioned to you, the party has a structure. We have the 1995 APC party constitution, which serves as the guiding principle, the document upon which legitimacy is derived for the National Advisory Committee, which is the highest decision making of the party, and these are duly elected members in the party. President Koroma cannot single-handedly choose a flag bearer for a party that has been in existence for decades. That is why even when the president was making the announcement in the jam-packed hall, his preface was, "I have been mandated by the National Advisory Committee to announce the flag bearer and his running mate for the March 7, 2018 election." So, which means he was making that pronouncement at the behest of the highest decision body.
Sometimes it's very difficult for the incumbent party to win re-election, and recently now it's been very difficult. Now, what are your chances of defeating the opposition Sierra Leone People's Party?
Well, our chances are very great. But for us, though, our optimism is with humility. We believe that the people of this country, when President Koroma was running in 2012, his campaign message was very simple. He said, "If you think I have worked in the past 5 years, even though we may have challenges, vote me in. If not, vote the opposition. I will be the first person to congratulate." It is the same humility we are entering into the 2018 election. President has worked, the party has worked for this country, and we are very proud of the record. The reason being, since independence, there has never been a party that has constructed infrastructural development in this country if it is not the APC. So based on this, our own continuity in governance is going to be predicated on our solid achievement, which is there for people to see. That is why the people of Sierra Leone continue to have trust in the party, because it is made up of the foot soldiers who are ready to deliver and taking the people along the trajectory of development. We are going into these elections with humility, but with the strongest determination ever that, yes, the continuity to develop this country, the APC is the only way out.
Abdoulaye Bereti is the spokesman for Sierra Leone President Ernest Bai Koroma. He was speaking with me from the capital, Freetown. A leading Gambian member of parliament, Khalifa Salah, says he's not convinced that President Adamman Barrow is doing effective major institutional changes during the period of his transition in government. Salah was addressing Gambians in the United Kingdom. Reporter Pandera Bai has details.
The Gambia is currently going through transformational democratic development, according to Khalifa Salah, the member of parliament for Serekunda. But Mr. Salah says the new political dispensation under President Adama Barrow's leadership hasn't also the system change yet.
What I have said, I think, is already clear, that we have regime change. We do not have a system change. Now it is that regime that is trying to put its act together. Our contribution is constantly to scrutinize, to criticize, to restrain, to recommend, so that it performs better, create a better society than has been inherited. That is the most we expect, as far as we are concerned, from President Barrow, to deliver a better society than he inherited.
Mr. Salah was speaking on Saturday in London during a town hall meeting with the Gambian community in the United Kingdom. A sizable crowd of Gambians across the political spectrum attended the meeting. Given the current economic challenges facing the country, Mr. Salah said he doesn't expect the new transition government to deliver the Gambia to system change.
We do not expect that he is the one who should be bringing the system change that was endeavored by the Gambian people after the regime change. Before the system change, most Gambians, 99.99%, wanted regime change.
Despite the massive youth unemployment, coupled with an unprecedented number of youths migrating to Europe through the back way, Mr. Salah is optimistic about Gambia's future.
This is an opportunity. As I said, what we have is regime change. We change the government. But the next change that is going to come must be system change, not regime change. And what that change will require is to engage those who want to be your leaders. They must tell you exactly how they intend to build your economy to eradicate the poverty and the low income of the citizenry.
The Serekunda MP also commented on the 11 million euros that the European Union has given to the Gambia government for youth empowerment and entrepreneurship projects. He says the onus lies on Gambians, including parliamentarians, to hold the government accountable by ensuring that the money is put into good use. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by reporting.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sportsman. Here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Good morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin with the announcement that the Confederation of African Football, CAF, have announced that Morocco will replace Kenya as host of the 2018 African Nations Championship, CHAN. The continent's football governing body, CAF, unanimously decided to give Morocco the tournament ahead of Equatorial Guinea after its emergency committee meeting in Lagos. The award of the tournament to Morocco also benefits Egypt, who were awarded Morocco's place, now free up as hosts. This is after Egypt were initially knocked out by their fellow North Africans in qualifying. CAF President Ahmed Ahmed says there were no sentiments involved in deciding the new host of the competition.
We thank very much Equatorial Guinea for what they offer for the African football. But now, they are not ready. Morocco is ready than them. We have no sentiment to decide.
In the meantime, FIFA have rejected Ghana's complaint against South African referee Daniel Bennett and his assistants following last weekend's World Cup qualifier away to Uganda. Ghana were denied what looked to have been a legitimate last gaps winner due to an incorrect offside call from the assistant. The Black Stars were hoping for a similar outcome to Senegal, who were successful in seeing their loss to South Africa last year, which was handled by discredited Ghanaian referee Joseph Lamptey, annulled by FIFA. In volleyball news, host of the 2017 Women's Volleyball African Nations Championship, Cameroon, has won the championship thanks to a 3-sets-to-love spanking of Kenya. Kenya, who were looking to bag their 10th continental title, went down 25-22, 25-19, 29-27 to Cameroon. It was Kenya's first defeat in the competition, which had brought together 9 countries, and it's gifted Cameroon our first ever gold medal in the biennial competition, which is now in its 17th edition. And finally, South African national cricket team, the Proteas, comprehensively beat Bangladesh by 10 wickets during the first one-day international in South Africa on Sunday. Quinton de Kock and Hasim Amala both scored centuries as South Africans successfully chased down a winning target of 279 with 43 balls to spare. The win sees the Proteas take a 1-0 lead in the 3-matches series. Quinton de Kock:
no, we never really thought about it. We just went out there, just trying to bat, getting the team close, and then we just naturally just went on just to finish the game off between the two of us. So it was just instinct and kicked in, at all.
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, October 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford and reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as host editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you to have a productive week.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.